My name is Jackie Lamport. Today is Thursday, May 20th. Welcome to the Capital Daily Podcast. Today on the show.
These kind of things are in the public interest, and journalists have the right to be there, especially when you look at some of the court cases that have been upheld recently.
On Monday, RCMP began enforcing the injunction against protesters at the KQ's location of the Ferry Creek blockades. The same day, RCMP barred journalists from entering to report on the situation. Instead, they were offered a media tour the following day at 7 a.m. We went to the tour and also spoke with the Canadian Association of Journalists to understand what rights journalists have at injunction zones. Today's Capital Daily Podcast is brought to you by Tressa, Victoria's first mass timber condominiums. Visit tressa.ca to learn more. That's T-R-E-S-A-H.ca. On Monday, RCMP began enforcing the injunction against Ferry Creek blockaders at the KQ's blockade. This came suddenly after a month and a half of relative quiet since the injunction was granted to the Teal Jones Group. It's important to know that the KQ's location is new and is protesting an active cutting block. There hasn't, as of yet, been enforcement at the main Ferry Creek blockade. Immediately after receiving the news, Capital Daily managing editor Jimmy Thompson packed his camera and a microphone and drove 2 hours to the cell service dead zone near Port Renfrew, where the blockades exist. But upon arriving at the blockades, Jimmy, like every other journalist who made their way down to witness and report on the arrests, was met by a roadblock and refused entry.
Hi. Good, thanks. How are you doing? I'm with Capital Daily.
Thank you.
The current media. Yeah. Okay. And I'm hoping to get through to the thank you blockade.
Oh, okay. Nobody's going through today.
Okay.
You have to contact Corporal Manso with RCMP Media Relations.
Okay.
And he's the contact.
Okay. I've spoken with Corporal Manso, not today.
Yeah.
You guys have, like, obviously there's no cell service out here. Is there any way to get in touch with him from here?
Not from here. So nobody's going through today. But you have to get in contact with him.
Okay. So you're not even letting media in?
No.
At this point.
No.
Why is that?
It's part of the injunction and part of the
I didn't see that in the injunction.
It's part of the operations right now. It'll be in place tomorrow.
Can you explain that a little bit more?
You need to contact Corporal Monso.
But I can't contact him from here. So is there like...
Well, you can drive back to cell service and give him a phone call.
Yeah, that's an hour and a half that way. And then an hour and a half back here. Is there any way like that I can contact you from here? Obviously, you guys are in touch with him. Otherwise,
no. We've been told to advise people that he's available by phone and tomorrow.
Okay, so he doesn't have any way to contact you guys.
No.
So how would you know if he had told me that
because
I can go ahead?
Because that's the direction that I've been given. I can check with the command post, but that's the direction I've been given is nobody coming through.
I would really appreciate if you could check with them because I mean that doesn't seem reasonable to not be letting media in.
Do you have also any piece of ID so we can verify? Do you have your accreditation or anything?
I have a business card.
Media accreditation.
That
media
is not a real thing.
Sorry?
There's no a media accreditation body in Canada. I'm on the board of the Canadian Association of Journalists.
Okay.
There's no such thing as a card that says I'm the media, so. Okay.
The instructions is to contact.
But that's the thing. Why the RCMP doesn't really have the authority to instruct the media when
there's an injunction to block and we're blocking the road today, right? Right now, you're not going to come through here today. You need to talk to Corporal Manso and get further direction.
Okay. Right. So there's enforcement action happening right now that you're not allowing the media to be there to witness or to report on.
We don't have.
So there's no enforcement action right now.
You're just blocking people from coming in.
We're blocking people from coming in.
So you're enforcing the injunction.
We're blocking the road right now.
Right. As a result of the injunction. Well, thank you both for your time.
Okay.
Appreciate it.
To clarify the legality of blocking journalists from entering an injunction zone, I called lawyer Leo McGrady. Leo has been representing media and journalists for decades. This is what he had to say. The actual act of blocking media from entering the exclusion zone, is that legal?
I don't believe it is. It's not been established affirmatively and by a court in BC, but as I say, there's the Newfoundland Labrador Court of Appeal decision that is very, very strong, very progressive, very thoughtful, reviews a whole series of developments in the law around freedom of press and our access to information. And so my expectation is that if the issue was raised in a court in British Columbia, it would be followed. That case would be followed.
Is there a case to be made for the journalists who were turned away on Monday?
Yes, there is. They ought to have access to the site, provided they meet those conditions, which I think they can easily do. So the answer is yes. They ought to have been granted access to the site.
Yesterday, the Ferry Creek Blockaders Instagram account posted a video of a person the blockaders say is a member of the media being arrested for crossing the police line at the exclusion border zone. The person is seen holding a camera and a microphone and is wearing a camera bag. They are told they are being arrested for obstruction. We called RCMP to find out the identity of the person and were told by Corporal Chris Manso the individual was not media. However, Ricochet Media says they have spoken to the man, whose name is Gabriel Ostapchuk, and that he is a documentary filmmaker. Capital Daily has not been able to confirm this information either way as of the creation of this episode. But here's the audio from the posted video.
Have you spoken to the media liaison?
I wouldn't need to. It's actually my right. This is a public road. I'm not breaking any injunctions if I cross this. If I cross this arbitrary police line, I'm not breaking any laws. So what's going to happen?
You will, if you cross this line, you will be arrested for obstruction.
Obstruction of what? What am I obstructing? If I cross this line.
And actually, we're going to be moving vehicles through here fairly soon as well.
Okay.
Well, this is public. This is public land. This police line and prevent public access on this road. Where in the injunction does it say that?
I believe this to be illegal.
Say anything.
No. Go on.
I also asked lawyer Leo McGrady about the situation if it was a journalist who was arrested.
The way the case law is emerging, there's a very clear argument to be made that members of the media are not to be treated in the same way as the protesters, and that the injunction ought not to have been applied to them. And in the case that I was mentioning earlier from the Newfoundland Labrador Court of Appeal, it's in the matter of Justin Brake, B-R-A-K-E, the court very clearly said that members of the media cannot be lumped in with other protesters, that they do have a special status and they are not to be enjoined provided they meet certain basic conditions. The certain basic conditions are that they be members of a media and be there in a reporting function, that they do nothing to interfere or obstruct with the police, and that the subject matter of the protest is a matter of public interest. And it seems to me, without knowing, as I say, the details of this particular journalist, that it's a fairly easy matter to meet those three conditions. I don't know of any media that has been at any protest that I've acted on that hasn't quite easily met those conditions. So I think there may be a very good argument that content charges ought to be dismissed, but perhaps more importantly, media have a right to be there. And that's not an aid of any economic interest of their employer or the media. It's an aid of the members of the public, our interest in a free press and a free media, and learning the details of this protest.
On Monday, the RCMP announced that they would be organizing a guided media tour of the exclusion zone Tuesday morning at 7 a.m. Co-producer Emily Vance packed up and left Victoria at 5 a.m. to be there. She now walks us through what happened. You drove down to the blockades yesterday morning, left at 5 a.m. to get there for the 7 a.m. scheduled media tour. What was the first thing you arrived to?
Yeah, so I think the first thing that I arrived to, actually the first thing that struck me was driving there, being completely uncertain about what I was about to walk into. And I counted, after I turned off Highway 1, I counted 8 logging trucks fully loaded with massive red cedar logs whizzing by me. So that sort of set the tone for the day. And when I arrived to the parking lot, there were probably between 10 and 15 members of the media there. There were 2 RCMP officers that would be our escorts for the day through the blockade. And I really arrived to sort of a scene of, a bit of confusion and a bit of controversy, because right away, media members started, questioning why we would be toured through the blockades with these RCMP members and why we wouldn't be free to wander through.
So tell me what your first conversation with the RCMP was. How did they explain what this day was going to be?
The 2 RCMP media relations officers, RCMP Constable Alex Baroub and Corporal Chris Clark, they were very friendly. They got us to sign in on a piece of paper saying our name and our outlet and, what kind of medium that we reported in. They told us that they would be leading us through the blockades in a media convoy, and we would be only permitted to cover the arrests in designated areas. And if we wanted to move from those designated areas, we would have to seek permission, or we would risk becoming a target of the injunction enforcement, aka getting arrested.
You guys always have to be escorted by either myself or Chris here as police officers for a number of reasons, but the number one is public safety and officer safety as well, okay? There's going to be enforcement action. We'll try and take you guys as close as possible to the enforcement actions, okay? Before you move any further, we'll be setting up a perimeter. If you guys have any questions, feel free. It's either going to be me or Chris that's going to be there as well. Feel free to ask us any questions if you guys want to move further. We just got to make sure with the team that's already on the grounds there that it's safe to do so. And if it is, we'll be more than happy to escort you guys there, okay?
What is the risk to public safety and kind of keeping us in a group and restricting our access in the area?
Yes.
Like, I mean, I appreciate us being brought out there. It's a crummy road or whatever, but like once we get there, why are we asking you guys permission to move here and move there?
Okay, so
it's public.
Yes, no, and I totally agree, but as you can see, we've got quite a number of vehicles heading up there, and it's very likely that arrests will start to happen.
So more for to keep us out of the way, right? So arrests can range from a passive subject that simply they're not actively resisting, all the way up to assault of behavior, right? And we don't want anybody to get hurt, and certainly if someone's in there and in the way, that's that increases the risk dramatically. Okay. Also for identification, I mean, I don't think you're going to be misidentified for anybody that's up there, but we don't want a situation where the enforcement action is occurring and they don't know who you are, and you're saying no, I'm allowed to be here, and suddenly you're getting arrested. So okay. Those are the main reasons.
Wow. Okay. So the pressure's on right away.
Mm-hmm.
You also, shortly before you arrived, you had received a phone call from our editor, Jimmy Thompson. What did he tell you?
Mm-hmm. So actually, the moment that I pulled up in the parking lot, Jimmy called me. And keep in mind, we're probably 5 minutes away from losing service. So the situation is, you know, it's a little bit tense. Jimmy told me that at midnight the night before, two members of Ricochet Media, two journalists, had been able to cross into the exclusion zone. Prior to that, on Monday, no media were allowed into the exclusion zone. And Ricochet Media really pushed. They questioned the legality of not letting media in to cover the blockades. And they cited court cases that the Canadian Association of Journalists later cited as well. The 2017 Justin Blake case, where essentially the Court of Appeal of Newfoundland and Labrador upheld the right of journalists to cover injunctions on private property. So right away, it was tense. And when after I got off the phone with Jimmy, I was under the impression that now media were allowed to go cover the blockades freely. I checked in with the two RCMP officers anyway, and they told me that they didn't know what I was talking about and that we would need, in order to gain access to the blockades, we would need to go with them.
Interesting. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
There's more journalists with you. You drive to the Kaikius blockade. What's that like? What's the first thing that you see?
So we drove for about 45 minutes on a logging road. I had no idea what to expect because we had been to a different blockade, you and I, to the Ferry Creek blockades. But the first thing that I saw when I pulled up, I heard the sound of protesters cheering and chanting and singing. The first people that I saw, there were probably 15 to 20 people lining each side of the road. And they were waving and they were greeting us and they were excited that we were here. We pulled up and we stopped and there wasn't a lot of direction from the RCMP as to what was going on. And so we all began to get out of our cars. And pretty quickly we saw that there was a massive group of people, about 75 to 100 people that were all protesters lining the police exclusion area. They were holding signs. You know, they were singing songs of protest. And there were some very powerful emotional statements that were given. Pachidot Elder Bill Jones spoke, and a number of other people spoke as well.
We are here to save our forest. We are here to save the old growth. We are here to save our future for our children. And your children and my children, we are, as they always say in these romantic things, we are one. And guess what? We are one! Yeah! Yeah! Yeah, our politicians are very skillful. That's their job, to divide and rule. And we have got onto their game now. And we are teaching each other their game. That way we will save our great mother's great old growth, the last of it. There's gossip that I've heard from foresters that 2 years, we're going to be bald here. So we have to stop.
Where are you standing? Where do they put you in the zone?
At first they don't really put us anywhere. So we park in our cars and then we're in this sort of media scrum slash protest that is unfolding all around us. And on the other side of the line are multiple police vehicles. There's a heavy RCMP presence. Our media relations officers are kind of standing around watching us. And then at a certain point, they tell us that we can get back into our vehicles. We get back into our vehicles and then we drive across the exclusion zone. And after we drove across the exclusion zone, we parked at an area, another blockaded area. There wasn't anything going on after that. We got out of our cars. We weren't entirely sure what was happening. And then the media relations officers told us we were waiting. The RCMP were trying to determine logistics of how we would all get down to the site where the first arrests would happen. And then we were asked to carpool by the RCMP. So we got in. About 3 to 4 media members got in each other's cars or per car, and we drove probably another 1 or 2 kilometers down the road further.
You get down the road, and That's when you see the protesters who are willing to be arrested. Does the arrest happen right away?
No, the arrest does not happen right away. So we get down there and it's a very different scene from what was going on at the line of the checkpoint, the exclusion zone. There are two protesters. One is a 68-year-old woman, Val Embry, and the other one is a young man. His name is Mitchell. Val is holding a sign, and Mitchell is just sitting on a stump and playing a guitar. And it's kind of a quintessential BC protest scene. It feels like the calm before the storm. And so we're told that RCMP, a constable, will come and read the injunction, and that when the arrests begin, we're only going to be allowed to stand in one place. And so we're given an option of two different places. And of course, keep in mind, this is a group of disparate media. We have TV reporters, we have radio reporters, we have photojournalists, and we have print reporters. So we all have different needs. And, you know, at first there's quite a lot of confusion. So I ended up going up to Constable Clark and saying, like, hey, is there any way that we can split into two groups by chance? And he mulls it over and then he says, yeah. And so I go and deliver the message to other media that we can split up, you know, but we're still 50 feet away. And I think it's important to note that during this time, the journalists that had been let in the night prior, they were given free rein of the site. And so everything happens really quickly. The injunction is read. The protesters are given 20 minutes to vacate the site. They can change their mind. The police said they would escort them out of the exclusion zone. They don't, of course. You know, we're stationed about 50 feet away when the first arrests happen, and I can't say that any of us got the coverage that we really needed.
So they were controlling your view of the arrest.
Mm-hmm. And the rationale, trust me, we questioned it many times. The rationale that was given was that they didn't want us to get in the way of the arrests, and that
okay.
It was an uncertain situation, and, you know, they didn't know what we would be up against, and they were worried for our safety.
This is a 68-year-old woman who's the first to be arrested?
Yes.
Ideally, we'd like not to see anyone arrested today. If people are insistent upon being arrested, then we would ask that be, you know, done as peacefully and orderly as possible.
Hi, my name is Staff Sergeant Charney. There's a civil injunction and order in place issued by the Honorable Mr. Justice Van Verhoeven of the British Columbia Supreme Court. Be informed by you blockading this road and preventing Teal Cedar and their contractors from conducting their operations, you are in breach of this injunction order. I ask you to step aside and remove the blockades, or you'll be arrested for civil contempt of court. By not stepping aside, I confirm you understand your jeopardy.
So the first arrest happens, then the man who was also there playing guitar is also arrested. I understand that you then decided to challenge the RCMP's control over what you could see.
Yes. So when it became clear that rules are being enforced differently for different media, that is when the designated media zones kind of fell apart. So I jumped in on a conversation that another journalist was having with Corporal Clark. And, you know, we both started pushing back and saying, you know, thank you for thinking of our safety, but that consideration should be up to ourselves and up to our editors. This is no more dangerous than any other situation that we may cover. And we just push and push. And this is while we are walking to the area of the second arrests. And, you know, the officers don't really concede, but I think that it's worth noting that the tone shifted considerably. And especially when, I'll say, some of the TV people who have deadlines, you know, it's already 9:30 and they have to be thinking about filing for the 5 o'clock news. We're in the middle of nowhere. And they're starting to get frustrated because they're not being able to get their shot. And neither are we. So this is when people start. I mean, it was all relatively cordial, but we were making clear that, you know, we weren't getting what we needed and it wasn't fair and it bordered on illegal.
So the next arrests, you do get a better view. What happens?
Yeah, so we're taken down to the arrests. We're told to stay in a spot, 50 feet away from these two protesters who were chained to a gate. And right away, one of the reporters says, I'm just going to go get some quotes from them, and walks towards them. And then we all follow suit. And the media relations officers, you know, they can't do anything. And they had also said to us, you know, despite the fact that, you know, they had told us that there was a potential we could get arrested, that arrest was their last resort. And we're all thinking, nobody's going to arrest a journalist here. Nobody's going to arrest, you know, 15 journalists.
That would be quite a case if they
did. No one's going to arrest 15 journalists here. And to the RCMP media relations officer's credit, you know, they were kind of like, okay, they were conceding and they were starting to see things from our point of view. Yeah, so we walk up to two protesters who were chained to the gate. It was an incredibly powerful image. An Indigenous woman named Rainbow Eyes and a man named Brandon Busby were chained together. Their arms were linked together inside of what looked like a PVC tube. And then Rainbow Eyes had a bicycle U-lock around her neck that was affixed to the gate via a heavy chain. And she also wore a red hand paint across her face, the symbol of missing and murdered Indigenous women in Canada. Mm-hmm. And she was very powerful to listen to.
We're chained to this ugly gate. It's horrible, and it's a representation of industry. We're here to stand for the people who have lived on these lands for generations. Government and industry are trying to take our lands from us, and it's ours. So we're here to stand up, and the time is now. Colonialism is finished. We recognize we're waking up to the world that we're living in. So we're just standing up tall like the trees because we hear the trees call. That's why we're here.
After you speak to Rainbow Eyes, she's then, alongside Brandon, arrested. You witnessed this one closer up?
We did witness this arrest closer up. So at first they told us, you know, when the arrests were going to happen, we would have to stay behind the gate. And then at that point, you know, that kind of fell apart. We were all moving closer and we had actually split into two groups. A group of us went up to the officers and said, hey, this could take a while. We have RCMP that need to physically free these people from the gate. So for those of us on deadline, do you mind if we wander through the blockade? And Corporal Clark had to take it back to his commander. And then they said, yeah, you have free access to the blockade. So we wandered around. I will say it's worth noting, though, we were told that the tactics that would be used to free these two protesters were secret police tactics. And so they actually, while they did allow us free rein to wander around, a number of officers held up a tarp so that we could not see what was going on.
And that's for a bike lock, right?
That is for a bike lock, yes.
After this arrest, are things wrapping up for the media? What do you do next?
I stand around and I witness the tarp situation because I thought it was interesting. And, you know, we were also there to witness the arrests. So we watched Brandon and Rainbow Eyes get walked up to the RCMP vehicle. And then after that, I just continued down the logging road. I spoke with another protester named Udi. And Udi was even more intricately linked to a structure. So he was sitting inside a cedar tree that the bark had been shaved off, and the cedar tree was not growing anymore. It was a log, and it was placed, dug into the ground, and a human-sized cutout was carved into it that he was sitting in. And then he was also chained in a variety of ways that I couldn't quite see to the tree. And obviously, he did not want to tell me because that's classified information. But yeah, I had a really interesting conversation with Udi as well.
Well, we're here as a movement to stand up for the old growth. And we're also here to take a stand against colonial injustice. So it's a united movement. These two things come together. And the provincial government has not done an adequate job of protecting British Columbia's remaining intact ecosystems. And so because of that, we've had to get here instead of John Horgan.
Do you have a message for people who are at home and something that they can chew on?
I'd like everyone to remember that this is a united movement. And anyone who believes in preservation of intact ecosystems, anyone who believes in human sovereignty, even something as cliche as world peace, those are all people we're looking for to join our movement. And there's so many ways to participate and help. And those can all be found online with quick Google search. And I just encourage everyone not to feel intimidated. Definitely don't feel like this movement is already over because it's just begun. And looking forward to seeing a bunch of new fresh faces on the ground and joining this cause.
We were talking, well, we've been speaking a lot with the media relations guy, officer that's been leading us through, and he said it could take up to, they're expecting it to take up to a week to arrest everybody here. What do you think about a timeline?
Well, these are delay tactics that we're engaged in right now, and every day that industry doesn't get through this road is another day that these trees behind us can live. Some of them have been living for 800, 900, 1,000 years, and every day counts. Yeah.
After this conversation, do you start to walk back up to the beginning of the exclusion zone?
I do. I start to walk back up. I think it's worthwhile noting that it was quite rainy on and off. I was exhausted and I was hungry and I was tired. So I began walking back. Along the way, I ran into a photojournalist that had been at the encampment for about 6 weeks, Camilo Ruiz. He had also covered the Wet'suwet'en protests pretty extensively and stayed at the camp as a photojournalist. And he talked to me about the differences and similarities in the amount of press freedom granted then and now.
Because I have a camera and I want to document their abuse of power.
Okay. Can I get you to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Camilo Ruiz.
And what's your role here?
I am an independent photojournalist.
And how long have you been here?
I have been here on and off for the past 6 weeks, I want to say, almost 2 months, and probably more on than off. Like, spent a lot of time here.
Why'd you come in the first place?
Because it was the right thing to do. The injunctions were served, and I knew arrests were coming.
Was this your first time doing something like this?
No. About a year ago, during the second raid in Wet'suwet'en, I saw the first one, and obviously I was troubled by it. And when the second one came, I knew, when the build-up came, and I knew that you knew the raid was coming, you could just feel it. You could feel the tension. And I was like, what can I do? I tried reaching out to contact people. It's obviously, like, very busy. I didn't get hear back from anyone, and I was just like, fuck it. Like, I'm just going to drive. I have a camera. Like, I've been doing photography for like 10 plus years, mostly analog, so digital was new to me. But I just got my camera, my truck, and I went, and I drove, and I got to a blockade that was preventing arrestees from being shipped to jail. And it was a camp that had been set up at the 27-kilometer mark. And I watched this whole interaction between DLT, indigenous leaders, land defenders, allies, legal observers. It's the same scenario as this. And I stayed overnight, and the next morning I was arrested along with legal observers and land defenders, even though I was clearly identified as media, had a reflective vest, said media, like I was, there was no mistaking me and my giant camera.
There was a lot of outrage about that at the time, especially like for very many reasons, but the press freedom was one of them. How do you feel this situation is similar or dissimilar?
I don't know if you've spoken to Jerome Turner yet, but he's here. And I met Jerome at 27-kilometer mark at the camp. And he was in the group of media that went to town because they had to file and post and publish and edit. And I stayed at camp under the assumption that, like, they might not let media back in. So I stayed where I knew there was a risk of arrest. When Jerome came back, that was, in my memory, the first use of their, like, exclusion zone, where media was, like, in this corner and don't leave. And Jerome pushed back and just sort of, like, went to go shoot when he wanted to and see what he wanted to. And he was detained. And I think they threatened court action then. They threatened court action last night because they were not allowed, this morning again. So this time it's interesting seeing them use the same tactics. And if we look at the first arrest, most of the media respected their exclusion zone. And a few of us didn't. I didn't. And by the next arrest, you could see that illusion of their power just sort of faded away pretty quickly. So I think, like, they know it's illegal. And when DLT came here to talk to us, they said media would have to be in this zone that they set up already, like, before anyone else came here, before any of this.
I guess what's been your wider experience at the RCMP here?
two-faced. I mean, I'm going to bring it back to Wet'suwet'en because I think it was an eye-opener for everyone, and I think the most symbolic video is the one that came from Tiendanaga, where you have the two DLT officers communicating, and it's like their last stand, their last chance to have like a peaceful resolution, and the Mohawks are just like, they're not going to move. And so it was these two calling, one of them was female, just like trying to keep it civil. And then when clearly that's not working, they just back away. And within seconds, there's like an armed fight. Like, that's the two sides. And just don't trust the DLT. We saw that up in the morning. They weren't good on any of their words to the people here and their concerns. And like, yeah, people are going to get arrested. And they just wanted to know the logistics of like, where will they be processed? Where can we get their vehicles, their valuables? Like, we're in the middle of nowhere. Like, this is hard terrain, hard to get to. And they just don't want to cooperate.
Yeah, we've been unable to find out where arrestees are being taken or how long they'll be held or anything.
It's not like they don't know this information. They know the information. Like, of course they do.
At this point, things are starting to wrap up for you and other media. How do you get back? Do they just let you leave?
Yeah, they just let me leave. I walked for over an hour to get back to my vehicle. I couldn't find the other journalists that I had carpooled with, though luckily they had left their vehicle unlocked, so I was able to get my backpack. But I walked, and it was a long walk. Yeah, it took me quite a while to get back to my car, and it really made me think... It's so difficult to get out to these remote areas and truly see what's going on that having this kind of hampering on press freedom just makes it more difficult to get the story out. In order to cover this story, I woke up at 4 a.m. I had only found out about the assignment the evening before. I drove to Lake Cowichan. I had to get gas. I had to fill up my windshield wiper fluid. Like, I had just washed my car and it was covered in mud at the end of the day. I was covered in mud at the end of the day. I had to borrow equipment, you know, to make this happen. And still, when we got to the site, it was difficult. So I think it just speaks to how crucial press freedom is especially when there are already so many barriers to journalists and the public witnessing what's going on. Interestingly enough, actually, the RCMP put out a statement last night saying they were going to change how media was able to access the blockades and coverage of the blockades. So Corporal Chris Manso, who is in charge of the media relations for this, told me this morning that journalists will be allowed 24/7 access into the exclusion zone, except for if there is active enforcement action, aka arrests, taking place at the time. Then they will still have to be escorted by a media relations officer. I wonder how much of that freedom of mobility that we enjoyed yesterday would be enjoyed by a journalist who was afraid to push back for whatever reason.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. So except for arrests, so that people are, you're allowed to be there when nothing's happening, but as soon as something's happening, you have to be accompanied by somebody who's going to control what you see.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it is a step forward to from not allowing media in at all. However, you know, I mean, we'll see what we hear from the...
What comes of this.
Yeah, what comes of this and what we hear from bodies like the Canadian Association of Journalists.
Yeah. Which we are speaking to Brent Jolly right after this, so.
Great.
Okay, Emily, thank you so much for putting in so much extra work on this and waking up at 4 a.m. last minute. This has been great, and we'll have to see how this develops because I assume it's going to happen quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the RCMP officers told us that, you know, they don't know how long it's going to take. It's hard to tell what kind of, you know, protests will be ongoing. But yeah, you know, it's my pleasure to cover this and stay on top of it. Obviously, as we've been talking about, it's really important.
Before we move on, we'll take a quick break for a word from our sponsor. Today's Capital Daily podcast is brought to you by Tressa, Victoria's first mass timber condominiums. Sophisticated one- and two-bedroom homes feature exposed wood columns and ceilings in an amenity-rich building located in Midtown Victoria. Visit tressa.ca to learn more. That's TRESAH.ca. To find out typical practices, why the RCMP are doing this way, and what it means for freedom of the press, we spoke with Canadian Association of Journalists Managing Director Brent Jolly. Brent, thank you so much for joining the podcast today.
Hey, you're welcome. Good to be here.
I want to first start with just getting the standard rights for journalists at injunction sites.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, journalists are allowed to be at injunction sites so long as they are following the rules. You know, typically they might list, you know, you have to stay within a certain distance away from activity that's going on, you know, sort of basic things like that, that you're not going to interfere in the execution of, you know, the events that are going to take place there. Yeah, I mean, it's pretty basic stuff. So I hope that it's pretty clear to journalists then when you go into that kind of situation.
Okay. Yesterday at the site, the RCMP were containing media. Originally, they were containing media to a certain spot about 50 feet away from the first arrest. Is that something that they have the authority to do?
Yeah, that's something that's appropriate. I mean, usually if that's what's in the injunction, that's something that they can typically do.
Okay.
Yeah, I would say that that's within their rights for sure. Yeah.
In this situation, though, originally they were not letting journalists pass through to the exclusion zone at all. And they apparently it was said that if they did pass, they were at risk of being arrested for breaching the injunction. Is that something that they are allowed to do?
No, that's something that's where we would definitely come in and try and intervene, because that's journalists have a right to be there. They have a right to be documenting what's going on, especially for a public agency like the RCMP. These kind of things are in the public interest, and journalists have the right to be there, especially when you look at some of the court cases that have been upheld recently. And that's that. So, yeah.
They did walk that back, and around midnight, some journalists were allowed to pass through and be there, but the journalists that had arrived in the morning for this guided tour were still not allowed the autonomy that the journalists who arrived the night before were allowed. This, like, separation, is that something that's not really okay?
Yeah, I mean, in situations like this, you like to know what the typical rules of engagement are. You know, what are the rules and regulations, and what are the standards that you're supposed to be upholding? You know, I think that that's just making things clear, so that you don't get yourself in an unfortunate situation where, you know, something crazy does happen. So that's just generally good practice, so that everybody can understand sort of what the rules are.
Okay.
For sure.
The guided tour, that's something that was a little bit off for some people. Is that something that would typically happen, a guided RCMP tour?
Typically not. I mean, that is, it's probably up to the journalists if they would like to go along with that. But typically, I mean, the journalists are there to do their job. They're not there to interfere with you know, the execution of an injunction, you know, a raid or anything that goes on that the RCMP is taking part in. So, I mean, I find that slightly concerning, just in terms of, you know, setting precedents, because, you know, we've had a lot of constriction of access issues over the course of the pandemic. And I think that that's something that we really need to make sure that, you know, doesn't become the norm. So I would definitely be concerned about something like that. But I'm glad to see that, you know, that there was slightly, the RCMP was slightly better behaved in this case, and allowed the journalists some more autonomy to go about doing their work.
Yeah, I mean, they did eventually through the day, but at the beginning it was kind of a controlled effort. What do you think the reason would be for the RCMP trying to control when the media can come in and where they can go?
I mean, I think it's about controlling the story. It's also about, you know, they don't, sometimes the RCMP might not know what's going on and or what's going to happen. And they want to make sure that there isn't, you know, a whole lot of evidence there to sort of see what's been going on, or what happened, or what should have happened and didn't, you know, what errors were made. So I think that, you know, that's a transparency issue that, you know, journalists are there to provide. I'm also conscious of, you know, there are a lot of times where, you know, police forces, law enforcement forces can set very broad or large distances away, so that, you know, maybe you could be there at a camp or a protest zone or something like that, but it's so far that you can't actually get audio or video, or you need a telephoto lens to see what's going on. So, I mean, there's different degrees of this that you really kind of have to be aware of and really consider in terms mm-hmm. of, you know, how close can you get and the rules around that.
I know that this is kind of speculative of police strategy, so I'm not going to claim that this is what's happening, but do you think there's a possibility, I know you just mentioned controlling the story, but do you think that there's the possibility that they don't want powerful pictures or audio to encourage other people to come down and also support the protest?
I mean, it's possible. I mean, I think that theory is logical. It has validity in this kind of case or in other cases like it that have happened. In this specific instance, I'm not sure what their mm-hmm. ultimate end goals are. I'd like to know, but mm-hmm. I'd have to buy a pretty expensive, you know, tool or crystal ball or something for that to happen. But mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that does hold water for sure.
Okay. My co-producer, Emily Vance, was down at the camp yesterday. Mm-hmm. She said that during the arrests, while they were unchaining protesters from trees and such, RCMP had put up tarp and hid the unchaining from media view. Their reasoning was that they were using secret techniques to break locks that the public wasn't allowed to know.
Okay.
But does that sound
I mean,
reasonable? Or
well, I you know, that sounds like a fairly loaded explanation to me. Not knowing exactly what secret techniques they have in the in the handbook there that they're trying to go with, but yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of that's de rigueur in a lot of places. You know, in the United States, everything after 9/11, national security, no matter what it was, you know, you're trying to go in and, you know, a bylaw for a hot dog stand, it'd be national security violation for some reason because they didn't want to get into that. So, I mean, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's been situations like that in the past. So again, completely plausible that was just a, you know, very loaded explanation for why they were trying to do what they were going to do, but outside of public view.
Mm-hmm. The RCMP did release a statement Tuesday evening that they are going to be changing the approach to allowing media in. Mm-hmm. The media will now be allowed past the exclusion zone 24 hours a day,
mm-hmm.
With the exception of when there is going to be enforcement happening.
Yeah.
Do you think that there's still going to be some more leeway made by the journalists, or do you think that this is kind of where we're at?
It's hard to say. I mean, from what I've heard from some people on the ground there, that, you know, that the police forces there who are actually enforcing the regulations have been fairly amenable and fairly well behaved. So, I mean, just coming back to your earlier point, perhaps that is something that is written to avoid having more people come in and create a big kerfuffle. I don't know. I mean, that's just a public relations strategy, perhaps. But, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, people were given some verbal warnings and things like that. But in this case, from what I've heard from those on the ground, it was very different, for example, than what happened in Wet'suwet'en last year, where everything sort of just collapsed. And so they've been fairly good about you know, moving people around and being clear and understanding that they're not gonna, you know, jail journalists, you know, willy-nilly just because they're not strictly adhering to regulations as they've been put out there.
I actually wanted to get into the Wet'suwet'en exclusion zone a little bit. There was some controversy there as well. Was there anything learned that the RCMP should be following from that?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the Civilian Complaints Commission, the report that came out of that in February of 2020, I believe, they made a point of noting, you know, the role that journalists play and that, you know, the way journalists were treated, to be very polite about it, wasn't up to snuff in Wet'suwet'en. So I would hope that would be something that they would take away. Maybe they did. Maybe they didn't. Maybe, you know, I'm an optimistic person most of the time. So I hope that, you know, incrementally things do get better. And maybe they did learn something in this case from that. At the same time, though, I mean, there's still a long way to go with this in terms of helping and making and having a dialogue, frankly, with the RCMP and police force about the role of journalists, what they do, how they go about doing their job. I think there's a really poor understanding. And that's something that really needs to get fixed if we're talking about bigger picture kind of solutions.
Mm-hmm. And just to go back to the original issue of media not being allowed to pass and being turned away all Monday, do you think that there's going to be any legal action from journalists against the RCMP, or could there be?
There could be. I think that there was some discussion about, you know, filing for injunctive relief to sort of see if the RCMP sort of dug their heels in. And that was a process that was going on yesterday, I know, and I was privy to it, trying to figure out, you know, what would, because potentially this could be a precedent setting issue, you know, if we're able mm-hmm. to be there at that very moment when it's heard by a judge to say, yeah, we're going to intervene on this. That would be a huge step. The way that the RCMP backed off a little bit yesterday, based on what, you know, what's been reported and what I've heard, I think it would be might not be the best for a precedent setting case in that way. But we'll keep watching, and mm-hmm. there will come a time when that happens. And I think that, you know, the advocacy that went on yesterday, you know, through Twitter and press releases and all that kind of stuff, I don't have any evidence that it had an impact, but I mean, I'm optimistic that it did, and that maybe mm-hmm. the MP took that to heart and said, look, this is not a fight we want to have right now. Let's mm-hmm. let's just do what's right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's helpful.
What do you think this says about press freedom in Canada?
Yeah. I think it's volatile, and it's something that you continually have to fight for. It's unfortunate because although there are laws on the books, you know, court cases that have been decided, in the heat of the moment, you really never know, because this is the case that we've seen. I mean, just on between Monday and Tuesday, you know, we didn't know how this was going to develop. If we did need to seek injunctive relief to gain access. I think from a big picture point of view, I mean, there's Canada is often seen as, you know, this, you know, bastion of, you know, goodness and everything. And I think, you know, there's a lot of good to be had here, but there's also a lot of things that we do need to recognize. And, you know, between what happened to Carl Dockstader in at 1492 Landback Lane several months, well, a little while ago now, you know, it's in that moment. You can never really predict what law enforcement is going to do. And so every time it feels like Groundhog Day all over again.
Mm-hmm. So again, this is just another fight that we have to do to make sure that we have the freedom going forward.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it's become part of the job. You know, there's a lot, it's tough for journalists. There's always this debate about journalists being advocates or, you know, neutral objective parties. But I mean, I think that we need to be advocating for journalists' rights at the end of the day. And from the position of the CHA, that's what we're going to do. And we're not going to be going anywhere. So count on us to be there.
Brent, thank you so much for this.
Absolutely. Happy to do it, Jackie.
Do you want to help support Capital Daily's local journalism and connect your business with our engaged and curious Greater Victoria audience of over 50,000? Email our partnerships team at advertising@capitaldaily.ca. Thank you so much for joining us today on this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share, rate, review, subscribe. We post new episodes every Monday to Friday. My name is Jackie Lamport. This is the Capital Daily Podcast. We'll talk to you tomorrow.